This is a podcast from RTE Radio 1.
So far in Speaking Out of the Dead, our lecturers have dealt with a mix of clearly dubious historical characters, as well as controversial figures about whom there are differences of opinion. Our subject tonight is something of a moving target, given that he's seen by Irish nationalists as one of the few 19th century British politicians to have had any understanding of or sympathy for their cause. William Gladstone twice attempted and twice failed to push Home Rule through the British legislature. On the first occasion, he fell victim to dissent within his own party. Second time around, he was defeated by a recalcitrant House of Lords. Paul Bew, Professor of Politics at Queen's University Belfast and the author of Studies of Parnell and John Redmond, amongst many other works, sees Gladstone's influence on this country as somewhere between ambiguous and malign.
William Ewart Gladstone is commonly regarded as the greatest British political name politician of the 19th century. He dominated not only his own Liberal Party, but large sections of British public opinion. And he did so from his time as Chancellor of the Exchequer in the early 1850s until his retirement in 1894 after four terms as Prime Minister. Indeed, before he left office, he was to become, uniquely for a British Prime Minister, a popular and widely admired figure in Nationalist Ireland as well, powerful and popular enough indeed to play a controversial role in the destruction of Charles George Parnell's leadership of the Home Rule Party at the time of the divorce crisis of 1890 to 1991. And while after that crisis the Parnellite minority in Nationalist politics started to regard Gladstone with some disdain, the great majority of Irish nationalists, of course, were not Parnellites, and they continued to revere his name. And he continues, in some sense, to have a good reputation in Nationalist Ireland. In 1938, J.L. Hammond published his Gladstone and the Irish Nation. Now, this is a very lengthy volume, and it constitutes the classic statement of the view that Gladstone was a noble politician. He argues that Gladstone transcended ugly anti-Catholic prejudice and saw the justice of the case for Irish self-government. According to Hammond, Gladstone saw the whole Irish problem with very different eyes from his contemporaries. Hammond wrote, "For many of them, Ireland was just a bad joke, amusing but tiresome. What distinguished Gladstone was that from first to last, he thought of the Irish as a people. And he held that the ultimate test of policy was whether or not it helped this people to satisfy its self-respect and find its dignity and happiness in a self-governing life." And Hammond concluded at the end of his book, "If the view taken in these pages has any truth in it, Gladstone was at once a great politician and a great prophet, a great Englishman and a great European, a great Minister of State and a great Minister of Justice." Now, it remains the case that not everyone finds it so easy to admire Gladstone as J.L. Hammond. Modern historical writers have tended to be a good deal more sceptical. Even Roy Jenkins, in a recent favourable biography, goes out of his way to make the point that Gladstone engaged in what we would call today insider trading. As a Prime Minister at a time of war fever and stocks falling, he knew, as Prime Minister, there was not going to be a war and made some very shrewd investments and then sold after the war fever had passed. Not illegal in those days, it would be illegal today. And there is something, frankly, rather appalling about Gladstone's self-conceit. Labouchere at the time caught it very well. He said that what he objected to was not Gladstone's assumption that there was always a card up his sleeve, but Gladstone's assumption that the Almighty had placed it there. It's a self-belief, a self-assurance, which contemporaries found exasperating, and many modern scholars have reacted against what they see as Hammond's piety of tone, almost Hammond's hero worship. Dr. Patrick Baum, for example, has reminded us that the young Gladstone in 1835 went to Exeter Hall in order to be in the audience to hear the Belfast clergyman, the tub thumper, the Reverend Henry Cook's bitter anti-Catholic preaching. And indeed, in the late 1830s, even early 1840s, Gladstone had the reputation as the rising star of aggressive Anglican anti-Catholic politics. He did change by the mid-1840s. Even so, the ease with which Gladstone disconnected himself from his early Protestant past is a little bit frightening. Lord Lyndon, for example, wrote to him in 1871 and used the word orange in a letter. He said to Gladstone, "Have you forgotten that in your youth you were not only a Tory but an orange and Protestant Tory?" And Gladstone's cold reply is, "I do not recognise the word orange." There's an ease with which he disconnects himself from his past. "You say I was not merely a Conservative but an orange Tory. I am unaware of it." From 1845 to 1865, Gladstone said little about Ireland. He was not a major contributor to the famine debate. Later in Dublin, he told an audience here that it was, quote, "by a severe dispensation of Providence that instead of 8 million of a population, you now have less than 5.5 million. In God's name," he said, "the sufferings have been suffered, the ties have been snapped, the ocean has been crossed." It's not a particularly insightful comment on the famine, but it is as far as Gladstone went. In 1853, however, he did pass his socially regressive budget, which shifted the emphasis of taxation in the United Kingdom onto the articles of consumption consumed and utilised principally by the poor. The Royal Commission on Financial Relations between Britain and Ireland in 1896 provided the basis for the subsequent claim that Ireland, as a result of Gladstone's budget, because it contained relatively more people, was overtaxed throughout the second half of the 19th century. In the mid-1860s, Gladstone began to talk more about Ireland, and indeed, increasingly, the Irish issue began to take over his career. Gladstone voted against the disestablishment of the minority Irish church in 1865, but in 1867, he claimed that the Irish church represented an injustice of which he had long been aware. And even his loyal daughter, Mary, thought that was a bit much. If he had long been aware of this injustice, why was he voting a different way only 2 years before? In fact, of course, most people thought they could see a pressing short-term political reason for Gladstone's change of mind. In 1886 and 1887, Disraeli had inflicted a series of tactical defeats on the Liberals over the policy of electoral reform, and there was no better policy for Gladstone to bind together the Liberal coalition and appeal to the nonconformist vote and reinvigorate his own party than by attacking the somewhat exposed Irish church. 10 years later, speaking in Dublin, Gladstone told his audience that he had only acted out of love towards the Irish church. It's not recorded how many of his audience actually agreed with him. There is no doubt that the Fenian Rising of 1867, and perhaps more particularly the Clerkenwell bomb outrage of December of that year, had a profound effect on Gladstone's policies. He remained initially a firm unionist, but began to talk more and more about governing Ireland according to Irish sentiments, Irish ideas. In April 1869, he told his Irish Lord Lieutenant, "I admit that the Fenian outrages and their overflow into England have had a very important influence on the question of the time for moving upon great questions of Irish policy." And indeed, Cardinal Cullen, who believed that he alone had the right to define the progress of Irish nationality, began to feel that Gladstone and the British government were too soft on the Fenians. The 1870 Land Act, the first of Gladstone's Irish land reforms, was a product of this new mood. And it signalled that Gladstone no longer believed in the simple application of an English model of agricultural development to Ireland. Gladstone was so infatuated with this relatively modest reform that he became to believe, with typical egocentricity, that the Fenians would launch another insurrection simply to stop the working of his own benign legislation. Even more strikingly in this period, he told the legendary and highly popular Protestant nationalist John Martin, who preceded Parnell in the parliamentary representation for Meath, that he, Gladstone, was more popular than Martin with the Irish people. Gladstone, in truth, was slower than most to realise that his brand of British liberalism was a minority taste in Ireland. And that is the clue to much that subsequently happens. In 1875, out of office, Gladstone published his essay, Vaticanism, an Answer to Replies and Proofs, arguing that Catholicism was incompatible with loyalty to the state, either in Britain or in Ireland. Went down very well with British nonconformists, to whom Gladstone was once again appealing. Just to spice matters up, Gladstone included a passage attacking the illiberal evolution of the Catholic Church in Ireland itself. He was widely perceived in Ireland to be acting out of spite. his writing in this period was seen as a revenge on the Catholic hierarchy, but the Catholic hierarchy's role in sabotaging his higher educational reforms of 1873-74. These had soured the last days of Gladstone's first ministry. It is but fair to Gladstone to say that Catholic intellectual authoritarianism had been worrying him for some time. In 1872, he gives a lot of time to a relatively obscure figure, a priest in Callan, Father Robert O'Keefe, who had run into trouble with the hierarchy over his ideas on education and the way that he was trying to develop particularly science education in County Kilkenny. And the hierarchy had fallen on his head like a ton of bricks. And it is very interesting to see a British Prime Minister regarding this as a serious matter, entering into correspondence with Father O'Keefe and actually meeting him. So Gladstone is not actually acting simply out of spite and revenge when he writes these pamphlets and articles in the mid-1870s. Nevertheless, we have forgotten how much outrage they actually caused at the time. Let me quote you from the Freeman's Journal, which is the mouthpiece of mainstream Catholic moderate home rule opinion in this period. There was a time when Mr. Gladstone was a loved and honoured name to the people of Ireland. Mistaken policy has created between him and them a wide gulf. He has himself made it yawn to such a width as to sever him from the Irish heart and confidence forever. So in 1875, mainstream opinion in Dublin, moderate opinion, took the view that Gladstone's anti-Catholic rhetoric had severed him from the Irish heart and confidence forever. Many things can be forgiven, wrote the Freeman's Journal, but among them is not the act of a man who places himself at the head of the juggernaut of English fanaticism. This is not the Gladstone who became such a hero 10 years later in Dublin. And it's also important to notice how Gladstone's writings in this period were received by Belfast liberal Presbyterians. The Northern Whig took a similarly hostile view. Does anybody seriously question the loyalty of our Catholic fellow countrymen, whether in England or in Ireland? And this was the tip of an iceberg of resentment that the Ulster liberal Presbyterian community, up to that point, very loyal supporters of Gladstone, felt about his anti-Vatican pamphlets. It has to be understood that for Ulster liberal Presbyterians, the whole subject of politics was alliance with Catholics. It was a necessary part of their struggle against the dominance of local Orange and Tory and landlord forces. And Gladstone's pamphlet had the inevitable consequence that the Catholic votes that they needed were lost. So their anger about Gladstone's illiberal tone and anti-Catholic tone was perfectly understandable in terms of the politics of Belfast in the mid-1870s. You must also think how they must have felt when 10 years later, these same Belfast Liberal Presbyterians, who were opposed to Mr. Gladstone's new policy of home rule for Ireland, were told by him that it was time to move on and forget the old religious bigotries. Having said that, it has to be conceded that there is a consistency and a logic to Gladstone's performance in his second ministry in Ireland between 1880 and 1885. In the first place, he argued and understood that his 1870 Land Act was designed to protect smaller farmers. If that act was not successful, and the crisis of 1879-80 had demonstrated that it was not successful, then there was a requirement on the British Parliament to produce a new major land reform. Gladstone was also a highly reluctant supporter of the policy of internment of land league suspects in 1881-1882 and escaped from it as soon as Parnell gave him an excuse to do so by offering to cooperate with his government. Gladstone may have deceived himself when he convinced himself that his 1881 Land Act fell short of the three Fs, fair rent, free sale and fixity of tenure, demanded by Irish land reformers, and thus respected the dictates of liberal political economy. He certainly deceived himself when he denied that there had ever been any Kilmainham Treaty with Parnell. If anybody stopped Gladstone in Parliament and referred in casual conversation to the Kilmainham Treaty, he'd cut them dead. What Kilmainham Treaty? We may think that this is a necessary self-deception, because the Kilmainham Treaty is in part a concession to violence and the activities of hard men, opinions like P.J. Gordon and P.J. Sheridan, and Gladstone simply did not want to admit it to himself. It is a telling sensitivity. Gladstone was hiding from himself the extent to which he was conceding ground, not simply to Irish democratic sentiment, but to Irish violence. and much of its subsequent exaggerated moralism on the Irish issue has its roots in this key act of psychological repression. And his treatment of W.E. Forster is a very striking example. Forster, the Quaker, man of Quaker background, who had come to Ireland during the famine, unlike Gladstone, and did his absolute best to alleviate human suffering here at that time. Forster, who had come in as Chief Secretary with the highest hopes for what he could do. Forster, who was unable to cope with the Land League crisis, for sure. Forster, who could not accept the Kilmainham Treaty, which is the very first of the ambiguous Irish peace processes. And Forster, who therefore had left office. But when Forster dies in the mid-1880s, Gladstone can't even bring himself to utter a few homilies. Absolute silence and shock contemporaries. But there is also a very clear and definite political logic at the heart of this new policy. In the autumn of 1881, Gladstone stated, "If Ireland is divided between Orangism and law-haters, then our task is hopeless. It is on that body and its precepts and its examples that our hopes depend. For if we are at war with a nation, we cannot win." As late as the 18th of October 1881, talking to the Earl of Derby, who didn't believe him, Gladstone told him he believed the Irish people as a body are loyal. And he says, "There are not more," says Gladstone, "more than 10 or 15 really disaffected Irishmen in the House of Commons." When it became clear this simply wasn't so, and it seems to have become clear to Gladstone sometime fairly early in 1882, everything changed for him. And the fact remains that from early 1882 onwards, Gladstone moved steadily towards a policy of home rule for Ireland. And this is entirely understandable and entirely explicable. He may well have had a personal agenda, as many English historians have pointed out. The focus on home rule made it easier for him to control his highly factionalised party. And while he kept the focus on home rule, rivals for the leadership, younger rivals from both the right and the left, split off and left him at the helm of British liberalism. And I think unconsciously this was part of what Gladstone was at. But, it has to be said, he had perfectly good and objective reasons, Irish reasons, conditions on the ground in Ireland itself, which explained the evolution of his policy. And I think it's important to understand that the experience of 1881 had been a demoralising one for the Westminster Parliament. The House devoted itself almost entirely to Ireland in that year. But as this one MP put it, at the end of a long session, devoted entirely to her needs, we find her more hostile and not less disturbed than she was at the beginning. But 1882 is a decisive year. The Ulster-born Liberal MP James Bryce recorded, "It is from the year 1882 that I date the impression that we formed that home rule was sure to come. It may be a bold experiment," we said to one another in the lobbies. "There are serious difficulties in the way, but if the Irishmen persist as they're doing now, they will get it." And Gladstone felt sure that the Irishmen would persist as they were doing now. In June 1884, J.J. Shaw, the moderate, who had lost to Parnell the chairmanship of the Irish Party in 1880, makes a speech in the House of Commons in which he says that there's no point in moderate standing in the next election when it comes up. It's going to be run by men of the Advanced National Party all over Ireland. And Gladstone takes on board the fact that the next general election is going to produce an overwhelming Parnell-like majority in Nationalist Ireland. Meanwhile, it's also important to know that through his private discussions with Mrs. O'Shea, beginning in early 1882, or the early summer of 1882, he forms an impression that Parnell is actually secretly rather conservative. He accepts his conservative good faith. She is very good at convincing him of this, and she is very good at convincing him of this because it is actually largely true. And as a consequence, he comes to believe that home rule can be implemented without any serious threat to social stability. But there was, of course, one great and outstanding difficulty: the problem of the Protestant and Unionist community, which is a majority in the northeast corner of the island. And on the 8th of April 1886, introducing his Home Rule Bill, Gladstone signals a willingness to listen to any ideas that the opposition to his proposals have about special treatment for Ulster. But at that point, those who opposed Home Rule for Ireland knew full well that Gladstone's party was split on the issue and that the legislation would not pass anyway. They therefore had no need to discuss special provision for the northeast corner of Ireland. A proper debate on that point could only have been driven by Gladstone himself. And in June, when the debate ends, he seems to close down the whole subject of special treatment for the North. Gladstone made no attempt to enter the mental world of his opponents, and it may not be surprising that he had no time for Orange Ulster, but it is much more surprising that he was very dismissive of that Liberal Presbyterian community which had so strongly supported his first ministry. These Liberal Presbyterians have been won over to the Union in the course of the 19th century by the process of political reform and by the development of economic prosperity. The point to note is that in justification of his political decision to embrace Home Rule, Gladstone constructed a version of political history which denied any merit at all to his opponents. The union between Britain and Ireland became an idea which was in conception and execution absolutely bad, and the alternative he proposed absolutely good. Let us consider, for example, how Gladstone utilised the political writings of Edmund Burke, the great British statesman born in Ireland, who had advocated in the 1790s Catholic relief and Catholic emancipation. Gladstone picks up, quite rightly, on this side of Burke's writing and thinking. In 1881, Gladstone wrote to Matthew Arnold, "Even when he, Burke, is largely wrong on the French Revolution, he does not lose his charm. Being as he is on other political subjects, splendidly right." Now let us link Gladstone's attitude to Burke with his attitude to the Union itself. He told the Earl of Derby that he, Gladstone, thought that the question of the Irish Union of 1800 was one which must be studied seriously. He had come to the conclusion that no adequate justification for taking away the national life of Ireland had been given, and he thought that Pitt had been persuaded into it by the King, who believed it would act as a check on the Catholics. Again, for the sake of argument, we may conclude that the Act of Union was a very bad idea. Nevertheless, Gladstone's remarks completely misrecognised what was at stake. The King did not persuade Pitt to attempt it as an anti-Irish Catholic project. Pitt attempted it as a pro-Catholic project because he intended emancipation to follow closely upon the Union, and the King stopped him doing it. The actual truth of what happened is the exact opposite of what Gladstone had convinced himself. The important thing here to understand is that the Union is an attempt to create one people of the United Kingdom. Now, it is perfectly fair to argue that by 1886, that concept had failed. But for one group of people, it had not failed, and that is the Ulster Presbyterians. Because for them it had worked. They were alienated in the late 18th century. They were inclined to support the United Irishmen. They were now, by 1886, fully part of the imaginative world of the United Kingdom. The imagined community of the United Kingdom was something that they embraced without difficulty. Gladstone had enormous difficulties with coming to terms with that. And in March 1893, in a typically tetchy meeting with the Belfast Chamber of Commerce, he dismissed their fears of Home Rule. He dismissed their economic fears in particular. But more interestingly, he told them they should return to the beliefs of their community in the 1780s. Now, time travel backwards has never been a solution for any historical problem. And Gladstone may have realised that this was not a solution. A few weeks later, he moved towards a decidedly more realistic tone. On the 3rd of May 1893, amazingly and bizarrely, but in a typical Gladstone way, in the course not of an Irish debate, but in the course of a debate on the working conditions of the mining industry in the British House of Commons, he addressed this problem again. What had happened was that one MP had raised the issue of local treatment, local conditions in the mining industry, and how they had to be taken account of, and said, well, do you not think that you'd have to take account of local conditions in Ireland as well with your policy? And Gladstone seizes on this to take the opportunity to say something about Northern Ireland. And he spoke as follows. It singularly happens that in the year 1886, in proposing the Irish Government Bill, we did face this very question. And we did state that if the inhabitants of the northeast corner of Ireland, forming a very small and limited proportion indeed of the general community, were desirous of being exempted from the general operation of that Act, he would be prepared to entertain a proposal to that effect. I believe that we made that declaration with the general concurrence of those who are termed the Nationalist Party of Ireland. So Gladstone is now saying there is a case for special treatment of the North East, there is a case for excluding them from the operation of a Dublin Parliament, and not only that, the Irish Parliamentary Party and Irish Nationalists accept that. Now, as usual, Gladstone was being more than a little disingenuous. His loosely phrased offer in 1886 to consider special arrangements to accommodate the Protestant North was, as we have seen, rapidly replaced by a public claim that any such offer was no longer irrelevant, and indeed by injunctions to the Protestants of the Northeast to return to the alleged traditions of the late 18th century. Given this, his claim to have won over the Irish Nationalist Party to such special treatment for the Northeast is, to say the least, rather controversial. Nevertheless, Gladstone's remarks constitute the foundation stone of the principle of consent, which is accepted by all subsequent British Prime Ministers dealing with Ireland from Lloyd George to Blair. But how many Irish nationalists in the 20th century, including those who revered Gladstone's memory, understood that? This, then, is the dark side of Gladstone's legacy to Ireland. The powerful moral self-righteousness he brought to the public defence of his position. It maddened those who could see the many self-deceptions and dishonesties which marked his Irish policies. But more importantly, he infected Irish nationalism with his glib and inadequate approach to the problem of the North. If a British Prime Minister could adopt such patronising attitudes, what incentive was there for Irish nationalists to probe further and think more deeply? Gladstone's lack of empathy reinforced a similar lack of empathy in the soul of nationalist Ireland. Had he used his enormous prestige as the first British Prime Minister to offer proper and just recognition to the democratic claims of Irish nationalism, to argue explicitly for a similar recognition of the democratic claims of Irish unionism, he would have been speaking from a position of enormous moral strength. He also missed the opportunity to cash his credibility with the liberal Presbyterian element in the North to disconnect them from the broader unionist anti-nationalist coalition. Instead, his impact upon them was to drive them closer towards that coalition. Gladstone did not do any of those things. The negative consequences of Gladstone's policies in the 1880s are still being felt in Ireland in the 21st century. Thank you.
Professor Paul Bew of Queen's University Belfast on William Gladstone. Next week, it's the turn of a 19th century Tory Prime Minister, Arthur Balfour, who will be discussed by Dr. Margaret O'Callaghan.
You've been listening to a podcast from RTE Radio 1. For more details of our podcasts, visit rte.ie/radio1.